The Monty Show. It's Monday, April 30th, and holy cow, it's almost May. I'm Monty, that's Jake.
Hello.
Hello. Make sure you find us online, themontyshow.com. You can find us on Twitter, it's The Monty Show, on iTunes, on Google Play, on everywhere you want to be, SoundCloud, The Monty Show. Today we're loaded, as always, huge news in Major League Baseball. On the website today, you know we got a full write-up on Jazz and Rockets. Make sure you get to themontyshow.com for that. And we will spend a lot of time today talking about Donald Trump. Towards the end of the show.
Yidge.
But why don't we start with massive breaking news in Major League Baseball today, Jake? It has to do with the NL West, which is where the heart lies, which is to say it is our favorite division in baseball. And you know that we are quite passionate as baseball fans, and you also know that we talk a lot of NL West. And I think baseball in general, frankly. But today the news came out that Corey Seager is done for the year. Corey is going to have Tommy John surgery, which is a huge deal because this dramatically changes, Jake, the chances that the Dodgers are going to be able to contend for that division. And just your thoughts in general, you're a Giant fan, a huge Giant fan.
Yeah.
So your thoughts on what this does to the NL West, the Dodgers, without Corey Seager.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously right off the top, they're losing a massive offensive player in that lineup every day. And he plays shortstop, and that's one of the most positions for any successful baseball team. You know, the middle of the field is where your money is made in baseball. And I think when you lose a guy as talented as Seager, he can hit home runs, he can give you, you know, good OPS, good on-base percentage.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he can really hit, and his defense isn't half bad either. And so when you consider, you know, just where the division's at, you know, it's really a three-team race, and right now I would say it's even a two-team race, and the Giants are trying to get into the race. I just think this is a huge loss for the Dodgers, and with where their money is at right now for this year, they're not really in a position to do anything about it. And when you buy talent the way they've bought talent the last 5 years, you don't have a farm system either. So they're kind of they're between a rock and a hard place.
So the Dodgers have said that they would like to be under the luxury tax threshold, which is $197 million.
Yeah.
They're at $200 million right now. So the idea today on Twitter that was floated was, well, why don't they just go out and trade for Manny Machado? Well, because Machado's owed $16 million this year, of which they would pay a prorated amount. But every penny they pay Machado, if they go and trade for him and they don't send a guy out to reduce their payroll, they pay dollar for dollar. So essentially you're paying him, let's say for the sake of argument, his whole $16 million, then you're paying $16 million more in luxury tax. So he's a $32 million player now. And I don't know that any club is going to do that.
Yeah.
The problem is, if you look at the Dodgers' disabled list right now, Justin Turner, Corey Seager now, Logan Forsyth, Yasiel Puig, Rich Hill, Tom Kohler, Julio Urias, they have a deep, deep, deep disabled list. And I really don't think there's any way to fix it. You know, I think when you have this kind of money and these kinds of assets allocated to, you know, really free agency, as you talked about, the trades they've made, the money they've spent to bring in guys like Rich Hill, who is not theirs.
Yeah.
I think you are playing with fire. I think you are asking, absolutely asking for this exact same thing here to happen. Having said that, I would be a little disappointed if the Dodgers didn't go out and make a trade to go and solidify themselves. I'm not saying that it's got to be Manny Machado, but you have to do something. Corey Seager's gone for the better part of probably 14 months now.
Yep.
And that division is now firmly in the desert with Arizona, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. I don't think making a trade means you have to go out and get Machado. I think making a trade means you need to get crafty. You need to figure out, okay, well, what can I do with the guys on my roster right now to fill that hole at shortstop? And then how can I bolster my pitching so that at least that's a super strong suit of ours? If I can dominate teams with pitching, and Kenley Jansen can figure it out because he struggled this year.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so if Kenley can figure it out and that bullpen can figure it out, okay, well, maybe it's not so bad. Maybe we lightened the blow that Corey Seager having Tommy John truly is, because it is a big deal.
It's a big deal.
Loss,
yeah,
man. Like,
no doubt about it.
When you lose a guy like that, I mean, I don't know who you want to compare him to, but any of the best hitters in baseball, he's right there. And so I just think, you know, you're right. This division is now squarely in the hands of the Diamondbacks. And I think barring any massive injuries like they had last year, I think they're in really good shape. By the way,
did you see who the Dodgers are playing tonight?
Mm-hmm.
That'd be the Arizona Diamondbacks.
Yeah.
So you're going to see it now. I mean, the Rockies are 5 back. The San Francisco Giants are at 500. They're 5.5 back.
Yeah.
In the West. And then you have the LA Dodgers, who are 3 under and 7 back. And you're looking at a situation where they had controversy all weekend long. You had a guy in, Cody Bellinger, who got benched for supposedly not hustling. I don't know that I agree with that. He hit a ball out to Triple's Alley in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And fell to one knee when he swung the bat. So he only made it to second. He didn't make it to third. And then he got doubled off on a line drive. And Dave Roberts chose to make an example of him. Then the news today that you've got TJ for Seager. The news that it looks like Yasiel Puig is going to be out for a bit of a time here. I mean, this is a mess. This is absolutely a mess. And I don't know that the right thing to do is to go out and spend money. I think you have a much better payroll situation next year. Are you willing to pay the luxury tax to get Manny Machado now and then have him, because you're going to have to sign him to a 5-year extension? Are you willing to pay the luxury tax to have Manny Machado at short for the next 5 years?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think that's a decision that they're going to have to make. But again, I think when people hear the term, you know, they got to go out and spend money now and figure out how to right the ship, I don't necessarily view that as signing the best available player. I view that as bringing on a collection of solid talent, of quality talent, in getting together a team that is outstanding defensively, can really pitch, and you're going to have to hit as well as you can with what you have.
But here's the other problem. Manny Machado creates a logjam.
Yeah.
Because you're not giving up on Corey Seager. Frankly, he's had this elbow issue for over a year, and now he's going to have the Tommy John surgery. So if you go and trade for Machado today, he is certainly the shortstop for the next year. Is Corey Seager a third baseman? Is Corey Seager a second baseman?
Would Machado be willing to play third base, considering he's played third base for several years? I don't think
so. Doesn't sound like it.
Doesn't sound like it, because he just moved to shortstop.
Oh, by the way, what about Justin Turner, who's your best offensive player right now?
And I would agree with that, 100%. He's one of their best players that they
have. And you miss him because he's been out all year.
How long are you willing to invest in Turner? How long can he give you that high production? Because he's in his 30s, first of all. And I'm not saying he's falling off or he's old or anything like that, but I do think it should be said, when major injuries come up, you have to start considering what the 3-year picture is. If you're going to go out and sign Machado, that means that you're saying to Justin Turner, okay, well, your time is done, because now Machado's at short. You're going to have to put somebody else at third, and Turner's going to have to go.
Yeah, that's an awfully difficult conversation. I mean, truth be told, that is a very difficult conversation. And I say that because you look at the payroll that the Dodgers are currently dealing with, and it is Justin Turner's probably the least of that issue. He's under contract for 3 more years, $12 million this year, $19 million next year, and then $20 million in 2020. So you've got him until his 37th year on Earth. Like, and when he's 37, his contract expires. So I think you're married to him there. The guy I think that you could potentially move is Yasiel Puig. I mean, once he comes off the DL, I would move him. Yasiel, and I know they've tried, but Yasiel's just not a guy that's in the long-term plans here.
But again, you were mentioning that they had tried, and that's the biggest problem. They're going to have to try harder. He is going to have to be moved. And maybe that is one of those acquisitions/investments that they made a couple years ago that now just really hasn't panned out. Because really, with all the hype around that guy, hasn't really panned out. I don't think it has
to the
level that they wanted it to. And that's a problem for the Dodgers, considering the fact that their expectation seemingly every year is to go out and get to the World Series and win it. And they've gotten to the World Series. They just haven't quite got the job done.
And I think the bigger question for me here is, where do you see yourself in the division? No team on May 1st that's under 500 is going to make the playoffs. That's just a standard. And you can get hot and you can go on a run, and it's only seven games right now. But I think it's highly unlikely, without Corey Seager's bat, without Justin Turner's bat, without Yasiel Puig giving you something, I think it's highly unlikely without that group, without Rich Hill, even though their pitching, starting pitching in LA is so talented, but they just haven't performed. You know, again, I wrote about this on the website today, themontyshow.com. They're really talented, the Dodgers are. On the bump, they just have not executed. So I don't know what you do here. Hinjin Ryu's a free agent next year. Is that a guy you're willing to throw into a trade? I don't know. I think you're doing is moving to next year. And right now, I think the team in the catbird seat, believe it or not, is the San Francisco Giants. Because I think the San Francisco Giants have a chance here to really, if they can keep hitting, if Longoria can keep hitting, if he can stay hot, if you can get Bumgarner back, if you can get that rotation, because you got four guys that you can count on every fifth day.
Yeah.
Cueto, Bumgarner, Stratton, Samardzija. Now, you might not like Samardzija, but he's a guy that you're going to run out there every fifth day.
He's not going to get lit up every fifth day.
So
the guy's an innings eater.
I think it's just one of these things where you just have to stay in touch with the top of the division. Robbie Ray's going to be out for a couple of weeks now, it looks like, with this oblique injury or longer that he sustained. So every team has injuries. If I'm the Giants, I'm trying to hang around because you don't have the inherent flaws that the Dodgers do. You have a really crappy bullpen in LA. That's not the case in San Francisco.
Yeah.
You have really good starting pitching who hasn't pitched well. That's not the case in San Francisco.
And by the way, it really should be said that when Bumgarner does come back, what's he going to be like? Because he will have missed the first month of the season.
Well, his arm's going to feel good.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. He's going to be fresher. He's going to have gotten that time off that he hasn't received the last couple of years because they've been in the playoffs and they've had success. And I think that's something that, you know, we see it in hockey and in the NBA and even in Major League Baseball with the Cubs even. I mean, the teams that go into deep playoff runs year after year after year, eventually that catches up to you. And so I think this may be a blessing in disguise if you're the Giants. I mean, maybe the Bumgarner injury sets you back early in the year, but you're right. If their lineup can get going and Bumgarner can come back and be the same old guy he's been, you'll be in decent shape. But I still think either way, you're still down five games or whatever it is at this point. And either way, the Diamondbacks are still in the driver's seat.
Absolutely.
And they're still in control of that division.
And you lost Joe Panik.
Which is rough. That's rough.
That's a huge injury. He's going to have surgery. He's out 2 months. He was a big part of what was right with the Mack Williamson concussion sucks for the Giants because he was raking. They've got their own injury concerns. All of that to say I agree with you. If you're asking me right now who's going to win the NL West, it's the Diamondbacks.
Yeah.
They ask me in a month, that could probably change. I don't know. But this injury to Corey Seager today kind of changes the shape of the division and changes the tenor of the division. I also think the Cubs getting hot and playing much better baseball changes the way you look at things as well. Because I still don't know what you make of the Washington Nationals. And maybe this is just me and maybe I'm reading too much into this, but the Washington Nationals are four games under 500.
Aren't we talking about this every year with this team somehow?
We are.
And this is Dave Martinez's first year. And you fired Dusty Baker after what seemed like a successful year last year when you lost to the Cubs in an absolute, just war of a series you had with them. And I just say to myself, what is the expectation for this team? Because you haven't gotten to the World Series. You haven't gone deep into the playoffs. You've gotten to the divisional round, and you've lost. And so I just say, I don't know. Bryce Harper's long-term viability is a real question there. You can't tell me he's not going to test the market. We know he will.
He's going to leave this year because they're not going to pay him.
Yeah.
And I don't have a problem with them not paying him. The issue is, what's the window look like?
For the Nats?
How long? Yeah, how long can you call yourself a contender when you right now are sputtering six games behind a very good Mets team? The Mets are going to try and improve themselves. They're going to trade Matt Harvey, which should bring them some chips.
I mean, aren't the Mets the perfect example, though, of what the Dodgers will never be or haven't been? They have homegrown talent that came up through their farm system, and that's they bought Cespedes. They bought several other players that contribute for them offensively. But in the field, they have a lot of their own guys.
Well, they've also sucked for 5 years. I mean, it has been a rough go in Gotham for the baseball teams, for the Yankees and the Mets. And now seemingly both of them have turned it around very quickly. But yeah, I agree with you with the Mets. You know, you have Conforto. You have guys like, you know, Ahmed Rosario, who's a free agent. You're getting guys like Adrian Gonzalez, who had a great weekend in San Diego, hits an oppo bomb like he's 25 again.
Yeah.
But the story of this team is Syndergaard, Jacob DeGrom being probably the best pitcher in baseball the last week.
After he cut his hair off.
Yeah. Zach Wheeler's reemergence. There's just a lot of reason to be excited about the Mets. And I say that knowing that Travis d'Arnaud is on the DL, knowing that, Plawecki, David Wright, TJ Rivera, knowing that all these guys are hurt.
Yeah.
And you're still leading the NL East.
And looking good doing it.
But here's the real question about the NL East. How long is it going to take the Phillies and the Braves to catch up, to catch the curve?
I don't think it's going to take the Phillies long. I think it's a three-year window that they are going to rebuild. And I think every time we talk about teams who rebuild, we talk about, with the Padres, it was Eric Hosmer. With the Cubs, it was John Lester. With the Phillies, it was Jake Arrieta this year.
Yes.
And they made that signing, and he's pitched well for them. And so I can't help but feel that they are coming. And
so that's why I ask you about the window for the Nats, because I don't think the window is large.
No.
I think you have to now have real reservations, and you have to ask yourself, are we buyers or sellers at the deadline? Because those are the questions that come up May 1st.
I mean, I think they're buyers this year, but next year,
I just don't see it.
You have all kinds of pitching. You still are going to have Harper. I mean, this year you're buying. You're going all out to win a World Series. You know.
Yeah. I don't think the Nationals are going all out to win the World Series. I really don't. But that's just me. That's just my opinion. You know. I think I look at the way that team's made. I look at the age of guys like a Howie Kendrick, who's 35, a Zimmerman, who's 34. Matt Wieters is an old 32. I look at that pitching staff, and every guy except Strasburg is 30 years old. How long are you hanging on to a Jeremy Hellickson? Are you really married to a Gio Gonzalez, who's a top 50 pitcher in baseball? No question about that. But Tanner Roark, you can upgrade Tanner Roark.
I agree. They're on the back end of the window, but they're still in the window.
Are they?
Yes, they are still in the window, dude.
Man.
Absolutely, they're still in the window.
I'd love to believe they are, but I think there's a real good chance Bryce Harper's gone.
Well, once he's gone, the window's closed.
Yeah.
Right now, like today, they are in the window. It's hard to say if this is the last year of the window. I mean, you can make a really good case that once Harper leaves, the window's done. It's time to offload, man. It is time to get rid of your assets and start over.
Well, we'll see. It'll be very interesting to see how all of this shakes out. But as I look across baseball, I don't think it's trends anymore. The Red Sox and the Yankees are legitimately good. The Baltimore Orioles are 12 games under 500.
That's
and they're 12 and a half
Why
games
have you
back.
Not traded Machado already?
Yeah, which I don't understand, because it's over in Baltimore. I look at the Cleveland Indians. They're a really average team, and the AL Central is a terrible division. I don't even look at it on most days. The Astros are really good. The Mets, the Pirates are legitimately good. They're a half game better than the Cubs in the Central, and I don't think they're going away. You know, I mean, with Gang coming back, we'll see if Kang make the major league roster?
Yes.
You think he does?
I do, because I think they want his bat.
Well, I think he'd like his bat too, But I just don't know that that happens. I think one of the biggest disappointments in baseball, frankly, is the Milwaukee Brewers, who I don't know how you explain the fact that they're really good and then they're just really bad for
pitching.
Pitching.
But that's what that says, right? Like, so when you go out and you win a few games in a row, okay, well, you got really good pitching.
But they, it's not like they've hit either, though.
Well, but in those games, I guarantee you their hitting numbers are really good. Yeah. And their pitching numbers are also really good.
See, and the Cubs have, you know, a 35-run differential, you know, from scored to given up. Because they rake and they have really good pitching that's really pitching well now. The Brewers don't have that. I don't know. I still don't know what to make of the NL Central. But anyways, to wrap this up on the NL West, I think the Dodgers are done. I don't see any way that they win this division now, and I think they're going to have a hell of a fight to get into the postseason.
Yeah.
Because that NL Central is really good. Every team but the Reds are over 500.
Well, listen, I mean, you look at the NL picture on the whole, and the Dodgers are not. Are the Dodgers a top five NL team on the whole?
Today, I mean, no. In the National League, yeah, I think they are. But everybody and their brother is hurt on that team.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it really is difficult. It is very difficult.
Yeah.
Make sure you find us online, The Monty Show, M-O-N-T-Y, The Monty Show. Bayern versus Real Madrid pick prediction for tomorrow on Periscope.
Ronaldo.
I'd love to say Bayern, but I can't do it.
Can't do it.
Can't do it. I can't wait for Wednesday, by the way. The Champions League, Roma hosting Liverpool. Man, what's going on with Roma fans knifing Liverpool fans and UEFA turning a blind eye to it? Amazing. But right now, let's talk the NBA playoffs. I look at this Jazz-Rockets series and this Cavs-Raptors series, and I think they're very similar series in that the Cavs and the Jazz made huge mistakes. Because if you look at what the Utah Jazz did, by getting blown out in game five, it just shortened your preparation for game one of the Rockets series. And you really had no time to enjoy the Oklahoma City win before you were losing game one to the Rockets. And I think that's a huge problem.
Yeah.
But in Utah, there is so much love and just so much happiness over the fact that the Jazz are in the playoffs. And my opinion is they're really good and they're way better than we saw in game one. And I know it's crazy talk to even say this. Rudy Gobert is the problem in game one. Because I wrote today on the website, themontyshow.com, M-O-N-T-Y, themontyshow.com. Rudy Gobert got outplayed badly by Clint Capella. And if Rudy Gobert is not going to be a factor in the pick and roll, then you shouldn't use him in the pick and roll because it really hurt Donovan Mitchell and Joe Ingles. And even, you know, Jay Crowder, who I thought did a really nice job getting away from it. But when you try to run pick and roll with Rudy Gobert and your name's not Ricky Rubio, it does not end well.
No, and I think that game one really solidified the idea that Ricky Rubio is the catalyst for the offense. He makes the offense go, and without Rubio, everyone moves up a slot, right? So that means that Ingles is bringing the ball up or Mitchell's bringing the ball up instead of Rubio, and that means your baseline picks to run your offense are not being initiated the same way they would be with Rubio in the game. And
correct.
So, then you start to think about, okay, well, what are my matchups without Rubio? And that's where you really get in trouble because, you know, you get a switch Harden on Favors we saw several times. That doesn't end well, obviously. I mean, even Chris Paul without Harden in the game was dominating. And I agree with you, that Game 5 loss, annihilation, was really the reason you lost Game 1 because you weren't rested and you just weren't ready for the onslaught. You weren't prepared. And so now you find yourself down 1-0, and this is where the magic of Quinn Snyder needs to come out. He has got to make adjustments.
Well, and I think we saw in game one to game two of the Oklahoma City series, they made significant adjustments.
Yeah.
But again, your point about Ricky Rubio, he's absolutely the trigger on that offense. And asking Donovan Mitchell to be Mr. Everything is a mistake.
It's too soon.
If Rudy Gobert's a problem, the other guy that's a problem as well is Dante Exum. Because this is where you need quality minutes out of Dante Exum, and you're not getting that. So now you're asking everybody else to do more. And whether it's Royce O'Neal or, you know, Jay Crowder or whoever you want to point to, guys are having to do things that they're not accustomed to doing
yes.
against the best team in the NBA. And it just does not end well. Having said that, losing game one of this series is not the end of the world. Jazz fans were tripping out with this game one loss. And I just don't think it's the end of the world to lose game one to the best team in the NBA when you're coming off of a long series against Oklahoma City.
Yeah, listen, I mean, even if you lose game one and game two and you go home down 2-0, I mean, you got to take care of business at home. And yes. I would expect them to win both of those games. And I don't think that's outlandish to expect that at home. My real concern here, though, is that, you know, you talk about guys like Dante Exum. Dante Exum has improved drastically since he came into the league. And I think that should be said, but he's not at a point where he's able to finish. He can get by you, he just can't finish.
Yeah, it's a huge problem for the Jazz because depth, again, and not to keep harping, but depth in this series will determine who moves on and who goes home. And I think it is easy for Jazz fans to say, "Oh, well, we're going home. We're going to get crushed here." You're not going to get crushed here. And I think if you are willing to look at the long term in this series, if you can make this nothing less than a 5-game series, you're going to have a chance to win the series. What that will require, obviously, is you going on the road and winning a game, which, not to be a jerk about it, you're going to have to play twice as well as you played last night.
Well, and I think the other thing we didn't see last night was that elite brand of defense. They
Correct.
Were not disrupting the Rockets on any level. The Rockets
yes.
were, you know, able to do whatever they wanted to do. And when that happens, I mean, we see it with other teams too. I mean, you know, when Golden State's running up and down the floor and KD's in the flow and, you know, Thompson's knocking down threes, you're in trouble. And the Jazz found that out with the Rockets. And so, you know, you look at the depth, you look at the lack of quality from the Jazz in game one, and that all adds up to a loss to lead off the series. That doesn't mean you lost the series last night. You'll lose the series when you lose a game at home because you didn't play defense.
Well, and the other guy that you really got to talk about here is Alec Burks. And this is somebody we've talked about for, you know, going on 5 years now that is just never going to live up to the potential. And when I was in yeah. Salt Lake City, I got crushed for saying it. But Alec Burks is just not a guy you can count on. When you want somebody to just go and dunk the basketball or attempt to do so, okay, well, go give the ball to Alec Burks. But if you're expecting him to run offense and be in flow, and that's not who this guy is.
Do you think that's what they asked him to do, though? I think
it's not what they ask him to do. It's what they need him to do.
Yep.
They need him to shoot the ball well.
Well,
they need
yeah.
him to kick the ball out. Because he really is the guy. When you want dribble penetration, Alec Burks is the guy you give the ball to. He's got to kick that ball out. Donovan Mitchell, and God bless him for his aggressiveness, but Donovan Mitchell has got to be aggressive but smart. He's getting triple team as soon as he steps that first step inside the arc to drive to the rack. He's getting triple teamed. You got to kick that ball out. And it takes a lot of discipline from a rookie to do that.
Well,
but he's better than your average rookie.
But that's the Rubio effect, isn't it? You're asking
sure.
Donovan Mitchell to make the elite decision. You're essentially asking him to be your LeBron James on that team.
What you're asking him to do is not score the basketball, which is foreign to him. Because all Donovan Mitchell's ever been asked to do is score the basketball. And now you're saying to him, hey, look, I know you're at the end of a really long rookie campaign, but we need you to take a step in development here. And we need you to drive and kick. And if he will do that 1 out of 5 times, they have a real legitimate chance to win this series.
Yeah, and the real trouble here for me at the end of the day is that, you know, when we look back on the OKC series, the Jazz were able to win with ball movement and knocking down the three ball. That is what the Houston Rockets specialize in, and they specialize in one-on-one basketball.
Yeah.
Earlier in the year, we were talking about a stat on this show, and it was something to the effect of the Rockets lead the league in one-on-one buckets, in
yes,
one-on-one
they do.
Possessions.
Yep.
And that's because they have the best player in the world one-on-one.
And they run ISO for him.
Yes.
And they understand spacing.
And then Clint Capella comes down and gets the board when he does miss occasionally.
That was one of the more disappointing things about Game 1, is that Clint Capella dominated. he really inflicted his desire and his will on the Utah Jazz, which really is not something we see a lot. The team was tired. They had traveled. They had spent their heart and soul kicking the crap out of Russell Westbrook. So I get it. Game two needs to be completely different than game one. And I believe it will, because you're going to have 3 full days. If you really think about the time on the clock.
Yeah.
They played afternoon on Sunday. They'll be off Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And then they play Wednesday night. So they have 3 full days. They have more than 36 hours to recover from game one, adjust from game one, and work on things. And Quinn Snyder and the style of ball the Jazz play allows them to make significant progress in short windows.
Yeah.
And that's what will need to happen. I don't think there's any chance they win this series. James Harden is playing out of his mind.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing defensively from Trevor Ariza, good Lord.
Well, and that's why I say, like, people, you know, question whether the Rockets are right here today the best team in the NBA. Defense wins championships. We know that. And then you
are they better than Golden State?
Right now, I think they are. I do think they are. But I will say this. I was impressed with that performance out of Golden State.
Were you surprised that Golden State beat –
I was surprised they pulled away like that. I did not expect that. I did not expect, you know, just the way they took over the game, frankly. I mean, I did not see that coming, especially with the way, you know, the Pelicans, and the word is dismantled Dame and the boys. I did not expect that. So, again, we're talking about Jazz Rockets and the adjustments the Jazz need to make. What adjustments are the Pelicans going to have to make? I don't know what it's going to be, but they have significant adjustments to make. And mainly, it's figuring out the dynamic between, do we focus on shutting down KD or do we focus on limiting the three ball from the Warriors?
That didn't work. Because they tried to do both, and that didn't work.
No.
And what was really surprising was that even though he had a nice game, and this is what we talked about, Anthony Davis didn't go crazy. He had 21 points that he had to work very hard for. And, you know, really, again, they didn't get a good secondary performance. Etuan Moore, I thought, played really well, but Nikola Mirotic was useless, which was a little surprising to me. Crawford gave him good minutes off the bench, but I look at the Golden State Warriors, and Klay Thompson and Kevin Durant ran all day long, got anything they wanted. And Draymond Green was that guy that we all love to watch play basketball.
Have they flipped the switch now that they're in the playoffs?
No. Because this team in Golden State is uniquely capable of just sucking out loud for 20 minutes at a time. Like, they just go into these funks, and it's shooting, I think, sometimes. But I also think they play at such a frenetic pace, especially when Steph is back, which they say he may well be for game two. When they play at that frenetic pace, I think they get mentally tired. And so they'll just take a quarter off.
Klay admitted he was tired.
Yeah, well, but you can't play the way they play have some level of, well, yeah, because the Pelicans get up and down too.
Yeah.
But we saw that that's not a good way to beat the Warriors, because a lot of bad shots, and I don't know why the Pelicans missed so much short, but the outlet passing from Golden State was freaking unbelievable.
And again, not to go backwards here, but this is what I was saying when we talked about who I would rather play.
No, please tell me how right you were.
Yeah, because I feel like I was pretty right about this. I would rather have played the Spurs rather than the Pelicans. And I think at this point,
it's hard to argue with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to argue with that. I want desperately to see the Rockets lose.
Well, I think you're not alone in that. I don't think they're
going to
lose.
I dislike that basketball team a lot. But boy, it's hard to think they're going
to
lose.
Is it enjoyable, their brand of basketball, enjoyable to watch or frustrating to
watch?
No,
because here's the thing about the Rockets.
Yeah.
I hate the James Harden 3-point jumper flop. When he goes up and jumps into a guy, and he hasn't even left his feet, and the official's got his whistle.
Well, you know where he got that from. That's a Kobe move. Right. That's where the whole thing
started.
But
I get that.
Yeah.
But at what point do we say, yeah, we're going to make a change on that? Hey, Paul George, screw you. What are you doing jumping in the air thinking that they're going to call a foul?
I was just thinking about that
play. When you clearly jumped into the guy. So wait, you're telling me James Harden gets that call every single night, but Paul George doesn't.
Nope.
Where did Paul George learn that from? Guarantee you it's watching the beard.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate the way the Rockets play basketball.
But listen, I think, you know, Joe Ingles is doing the same thing. A lot of guys are doing it. It's not as though our favorite players aren't doing it.
Yeah, but James Harden does it differently. And I like James Harden as a player.
I mean,
I do.
He abuses the foul call. I'll give you that.
The
step-back
three-pointer is beautiful.
Yeah.
I cannot stand that flop on the three-pointer. There's no reason for it. He's using it to get to the bonus, because they shoot the free throws really well.
Yeah.
And the officials are doing nothing to stop that. And it makes me crazy. It is such garbage to watch James Harden throw his arms up in the air and the replay shows no contact. Foul. And it's like, do you even have to touch the guy?
Well, we saw that in the OKC series. You don't.
It's maddening. And sadly, it's why the Rockets win a lot of games. Because James Harden... James Harden is untouchable. Like, Joe Ingles doesn't have a problem staying in front of James Harden. But he does, because you can't even breathe on him.
Yeah.
And the Jazz need Jingles to be in the game. It just brings another advantage to the Rockets that I think is completely ridiculous. I do, because who on the Jazz gets that call?
Not on the road, nobody.
But at home.
I think they got their fair share of calls.
Donovan's not getting that call at home. Donovan doesn't get a lot of calls at home. He doesn't. And that's my point. Who's their number two guy? It's Rudy Gobert. Rudy Gobert does not get a volume of foul calls. And he gets hacked every time. He does a great... If you watch Rudy Gobert play basketball, he does a great job of keeping the ball up. A lot of big men will bring the ball down. He does not do that. Rudy Gobert keeps the ball up in the air. And if you just watch his arms, he gets fouled on a regular basis. He gets fouled on a regular basis. And it drives me nuts. It absolutely drives me nuts that he does not get those calls. And James Harden flops on three-point shots, never gets touched, and they blow the whistle. Okay, I feel better. Cavs Raptors. What, you have nothing? This is a talk show. You got
to
talk.
I mean, I don't know what you want me to say. It's reputation. It's the NBA. I mean, we all know.
It's garbage.
Well, it might be garbage, but that's what it is. That is the NBA. I mean, what do you want people to say about it? LeBron's getting calls. You know, Harden's getting calls. Russ got calls. You know, Melo got calls. But it's the Jazz. That is the life you live when you're not a New York team or, you know, a big market team with a big-time star.
Cavs Raptors.
Mm-hmm. A lot of big-time stars.
I think the Cavs are going to win that series. I hate to say it.
I don't know about that.
And I think there's a legitimate chance the Celtics can get up and down with the 76ers. I think that's not going to be... Everybody's calling that a sweep, and the Sixers are going to dominate.
No,
that's not going to happen.
No.
It's not going to happen. And my feeling is, I think it is 70-30 that the... 60-40 that the Cavs win their series. I think it's 55-45 that the Celtics win their series.
Yeah, I think the Celtics-Sixers series is a lot closer than the Raptors-Cavs series, but I don't know that I put the Cavs ahead in that series. From what I saw in the Pacers series, the Pacers pushed the Cavs to Game 7, and that's really saying something. But why?
Why? Because the Pacers are physical. The Pacers get in your head. Lance Stephenson wrote about this on the website today. TheMontyShow.com wrote about this today. Lance Stephenson should not be playing in the NBA, but he has a role. And it's to throw Green to the floor and fall on top of him. It's to blow in LeBron James's ear. Now, he also occasionally makes a three and he rebounds okay. But his job is to piss people off. And it worked in that series. But now flip the coin. The only guy who's a true matchup problem for the Cleveland Cavaliers is Jonas Valanciunas. That's the guy that's going to give them all kinds of problems. And this is why everybody's all excited about, oh, Tristan Thompson had a rebirth. And well, what's he going to do with Valanciunas, who's faster, stronger, more athletic, and more basketball savvy than Tristan Thompson is? Tristan Thompson was able to play well in 5 and 7 because he gets to the middle of the paint. He's a what we call a rim runner. Tristan Thompson runs from rim to rim to rim. Valachunas doesn't let you do that because he's going to stick his shoulder in your chest. Who do the Pacers have to do that? Look at what J.R. Smith did really well in that series. He stayed in front of Oladipo, and then when he let him go into the middle of the paint, nobody stepped up. They were late rotating. It's going to have to be critical because I think, I don't know who J.R. winds up on. My guess is that he'll probably wind up on DeMar, your boy. But J.R. Smith can legitimately defend.
Yeah.
I think this is going to be a very close series. Who does LeBron guard?
That's all dependent on who the Raptors have on the floor. I mean, LeBron can guard a big or a small. I don't know. That's a really interesting question because it depends who's on the floor. He guards so many different players.
What about this? What if the Cavs go small? What if they start Kevin Love at the 5?
I wouldn't do that.
I would. Why wouldn't you?
Because
you're gonna see some of those sets.
Listen, the Raptors are a team that will need to play quickly to beat the Cavs. They're not going to be able to beat the Cavs in the half court. I mean, we saw that when Kevin Love came back in the first game back. The Raptors at the end of that game they were playing half court ball. And what happened? LeBron beat them on a drive to the right side of the paint, kicked it to the corner, bada boom, bada bing. Kevin Love splashed it. Game over.
Yep.
That can't happen in this series consistently. I mean, LeBron's going to get his, of course, but, you know, the DeMars and the Kyle Lowry's and the kid from Utah, DeLon Wright,
yeah,
he's really going to have to contribute. And that it's going to take a total team performance to beat the Cavs, and they're capable of it. They just haven't shown it. And every year I find myself disappointed in the Raptors, and I don't know that that's going to change this year.
Well, I look at what the Cavs were in game 7, James, Love, Thompson, Korver, Smith, and then Jeff Green off the bench, Jordan Clarkson off the bench, George Hill off the bench, who I think will start if his back allows him to, and then Rodney Hood very much minimized. But see, I think that changes now because I think Tristan Thompson can play, but can Tristan Thompson guard Jakob Poeltl? That's going to be a very difficult matchup for Tristan Thompson.
That's a better matchup than Valanciunas, I can tell you that.
Yeah, but that's my point. Kevin Love can guard Valanciunas. Valanciunas cannot guard Kevin Love. And I think that's part of the beauty. Kevin Love's a different player than he was when he came into the league, mainly because he lost all that weight. Now he runs the floor really well. He is an elbow three shooter. He's not a guy that's going to post you up. So that's going to allow, if Kevin Love is on the perimeter and Valanciunas is guarding him, that allows LeBron James, who was dominant in the post in this Pacer series, that allows LeBron James a lot more room to post up.
Yeah.
That's the matchup that you're going to have to figure out. Who on the Raptors winds up guarding LeBron James? To me, it's a fascinating matchup. And I really, I know it sounds crazy, but I do believe that the Cleveland Cavaliers have more than a puncher's chance of beating the Raptors. And I feel like reading all the reviews and stuff and reading all the series previews, I'm the only one who thinks that. But I think it is going to be fascinating to see how that series turns out.
Well, listen, I think the biggest concern I have about the Cavs in this series is the fact that the Pacers were stomping them in several instances inside of each game, and they couldn't close the deal. They allowed the Cavs to come back. And in my opinion, the Raptors won't allow that. I mean, it would take some sensational act of LeBron James to defy the Raptors. I think if the Cavs are in a position where they're down by like 15, like they were in the Pacers series, I can't remember which game it was, they were down big, and they came back, that's not going to happen in this series. They're going to have to hang tight the whole game to win games, and that's my biggest concern. I do think they can win the series, and I do think LeBron James is capable of going to the finals. I just think the road is going to be very tough this year. Very tough this year.
I would agree.
You know, all the articles I'm seeing is it's LeBron James and everybody else. I don't necessarily think that's true. I think J.R. Smith is a solid contributor defensively. Kevin Love is his guy.
But the guy, you know, who's going to have to really step up in the series. Well, Korver won. Larry Nance Jr. is going to have to play well because Serge Ibaka is a handful.
Yeah.
Well, and athletically, Nance is really the only guy who can stay with him. I mean, it's I know it sounds crazy, but the way that you win games is that you – I think you have to start Kevin Love at center against Toronto. And I think you have to figure out where is George Hill in this series. Because if he can play and he can start, you can not worry about Kyle Lowry. Because George Hill can defend.
Yeah.
And he can get to the rack. So, I don't know. I really am looking forward
to that.
It's
really even.
I cannot wait.
It's very even. I will say, though, that, you know, defensively, the Cavs are going to have to be a lot better. They're going to have to be a lot better as a team for this to work out.
I could see, honestly, I could see playing Jeff Green starter's minutes, 25, 30 minutes in those games. I could see, you know, obviously you're going to play. But here's my question. You're starting LeBron, Kevin Love. I would think J.R. Smith. And then, really, I think you have a lot of options. George Hill as your four. And then you got to figure out, is Larry Nance a guy that you're willing to play heavy minutes at the power forward? I don't know.
Again, this is another example of you got to play game one and see how game one goes and what the Raptors want to do.
Yeah, because you're on the road here.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, too,
you're on the road.
A lot of people aren't talking about. You don't have home court advantage. You know, you don't.
Correct.
And that's a big deal.
All right, shut up.
Thank you. Good talk.
Cavs, Raptors. Who's winning the series?
Raptors in six.
I'm gonna take the Cavs in seven.
Okay.
I'm gonna take the Cavs in seven, and don't be surprised if they get one of the first two games.
Okay.
LeBron is
tired.
I don't agree with that. He had some cramping issues, and everybody said, "Well, he looks tired."
I'm not saying he looks tired. I'm saying it's physically impossible for him not to be tired after this entire
year. Sure, sure.
He's not. Even if he were to get to the finals, he will not perform at the same level he would have in prior years.
I think it's going to be really difficult for them to get to the finals.
Yeah.
And I know I give Boston a healthy opportunity there, but you have to default to the Sixers winning that series. I can't see them beating the Sixers in a long
series. I don't
know
who guards Embiid.
Kevin Love. And that's the beauty of Kevin Love.
Maybe.
Obviously Embiid's longer and stronger. The real question is, who guards Ben Simmons? That's going to be LeBron James. It's going to have to be LeBron James. Anyway, the numbers don't add up for LeBron and the Cavs to go back to the finals. I think the matchup with Toronto is
great. It'll be a great series.
Cannot wait. Cannot wait for that series. Cannot wait. We have to play one bite from the NFL draft. We have intentionally stayed away from the NFL draft because I think it's beaten to a pulp. Okay, but David Akers did something over the weekend at the draft in Dallas, Texas, that was beautiful. David Akers was the kicker for the Philadelphia Eagles last year. And the Eagles, you may have heard, I don't know if you know this or not, but the Eagles won the Super Bowl. And David Akers let everybody in Dallas know that.
What's up, Dallas? We heard you. As an undrafted free agent, representing that shield for 15 years. Tonight, I'm representing the Philadelphia Eagles, NFC East champs, divisional champs, NFC champs,
woo!
And world champs, the world champs. Hey, Dallas, the last time you were in the Super Bowl, these draft picks weren't born. Tonight, we are welcoming into the Eagles family with the 49th pick in the 2018 draft. The NFL would like to represent the Philadelphia Eagles, Dallas Goedert.
The Eagles drafted a guy with the first name Dallas in
perfect.
Dallas.
Absolutely perfect.
I love that. And that's why I love the NFC East. I'm not a fan of any team in that division. Certainly not the Dallas Cowboys, but I love the rivalries in the NFC East. How about Jason Witten walking away from the Dallas Cowboys And the Cowboys say they blindsided. They were blindsided by Witten, who's going to get paid double what the Cowboys were going to pay him to be the analyst on the Monday Night Football games.
Why wouldn't you, bro?
And you don't get CTE calling football games on TV.
Bro, you've already had a great career. You know, set many records. You're one of the best tight ends to ever do it. One of the most famous tight ends to do it, I might add, as well.
Yeah.
And by the way, the job you're getting paid double to do is actually a fun job.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you, man? I don't blame you.
I love it. So anyway, thank you, David Akers. I appreciate
that. He has, before we leave this.
Yes.
He has just enough Southern draw to make that clip just perfect. Like, if he had just a Boston accent, that wouldn't have worked. But because he's a Southern country boy, it works just perfectly.
I would agree with that. I would absolutely agree with that. All right, find me online, The Monty Show. M-O-N-T-Y, The Monty Show. You can also find me on Facebook. Guess what it is? The Monty Show. We had a post up today about how Donald Trump could possibly win the Nobel Peace Prize. And it's because South Korea's President Moon said that Donald should win the Peace Prize for what he did to bring Kim Jong-un to the table and you know, possibly end. I don't want to get ahead of it, but possibly end the Korean War.
And I think people are getting ahead of it.
Oh, yeah. Everybody thinks they denuclearized and the Korean War is over. It's not. They're negotiating. But people freaked out over that. And, you know, it's really fun. It is really fun. When you post a Donald Trump story on Facebook, people freak out.
Lit.
Oh, man. The comment section on my Facebook page.
Amazing.
People freaked out. Like, I was talking with some people yesterday during the Talladega race.
Dega,
which, by the way, anytime Joey Logano wins a race, it's very disappointing. But anyway, here nor there.
Yeah, we get it.
So during Talladega, I was talking to people on Facebook. And we were talking about the Nobel Peace Prize. And, oh, man, people are like, no, no, no. And it's like, dude, I didn't vote for Donald Trump, and I'm not begrudging you if you did. The guy deserves a shot at the Nobel Peace Prize if the Korean War ends and they denuclearize the Korean Peninsula.
That's a huge if.
Huge if. There's so long
wait,
to
wait,
go.
Wait, wait, wait.
So
huge
long to go.
If.
Huge. Huge. Huge if. But here's the other thing.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out where Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump are going to do their little summit. And now Kim Jong-un's like, let's do it right on the border of South Korea and North Korea in the DMZ, the Demilitarized
yes.
Zone, which I think would be fascinating. But they don't even know where they're going to meet yet. But the thing I want people to understand is you can hate Donald Trump if you want. But presidents for years have tried to get North Korea and South Korea to mend fences. And they've never been able to do it. There's no doubt that Donald Trump played a significant role in getting Kim Jong-un back to the table. Even if it is just that he pissed off Kim Jong-un so badly that he Kim Jong-un built the biggest nuke he could to test under a mountain, and it was so big it collapsed his mountain. I'm not even joking about
hilarious,
that. And I know I've told
dude.
This
hilarious.
3 days in a row on this show.
And people don't buy it. It happened.
Kim Jong-un did his nuclear tests under a mountain. He did so many, and the last one was so big, the mountain collapsed. That's a true story. He has nowhere to test his nukes. So even if it is just that Donald Trump pissed off Kim Jong-un so much that he made the biggest mistake building a huge bomb that collapsed a mountain, Donald Trump did that. And he threatened and he talked about Little Rocket Man and
my big
button. And hey, listen, it doesn't matter how he did it. He did it. And if it happens, he deserves credit for it.
But does he deserve a Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, Trump supporters would tell you yes, because Barack Obama's got one. And I think Trump supporters, his base, and Donald Trump would love to say, well, look, we got one too. Big deal.
His base.
His base. I love that word. He's pandering to his base. Okay, great, cool.
Nice rally speech, bro.
Yeah. Hope you enjoyed Michigan. But anyway, my point is, he deserves it if it happens.
Yeah.
If they end the war, if they denuclearize the peninsula, Donald Trump deserves credit for that. Is that worthy of a Nobel Peace Prize? Eh, I don't know.
You can make a case both ways.
Eh, I don't know. It could. It couldn't. I have no idea. I wouldn't give him a Nobel Peace Prize just for the fact of what he said about Dreamers and DACA and immigration and, you know, what he's done for racial inequity in this country.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the anti-Nobel.
To grow the gap. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that conversation. But I also have to think that if he's up for a Nobel Peace Prize, are you telling me that Stormy Daniels doesn't deserve one as well?
She does.
She doesn't. I'm kidding. Stormy Daniels today filed a defamation suit against Donald Trump for a tweet that said a forensic sketch of a man who allegedly threatened her in 2011 was, quote, a total con job. End quote. That's a direct quote from Donald Trump's Twitter.
Don, bro, listen, you had a win.
Dude.
You had a win, and then, you know, look, help.
Stormy Daniels, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford.
Stormy.
Is Stephanie Clifford that less sexual than Stormy Daniels? It probably is. Stephanie Clifford Stormy Daniels claims that she had a sexual encounter with Trump in 2006.
David Dennison.
She was warned by an unidentified... Hello. Freudian slip there. You said David Dennison. I said warmed. My bad. She was warned by an unidentified man to keep quiet about it 5 years later after she gave an interview to a gossip magazine. Earlier this month, Stormy worked on a sketch with a forensic artist to create a sketch of a man who essentially looks like Tom Brady. But she says this Tom Brady lookalike.
Bro, winner.
She says this Tom Brady lookalike is the guy that walked up behind her and threatened her.
Did he have Ugg boots?
Apparently. But she's saying, the guy said to her, leave Trump alone, forget the story, and suggested to Stormy Daniels that Stormy's young toddler is beautiful and it would be a shame if that toddler didn't have her mother. And then left Stormy alone.
I'm going to go and say that happened.
The lawsuit filed on Monday in federal court in Manhattan talks about an April 18th post on Trump's Twitter account in which he reacts to another person's tweet about the sketch. Trump said on Twitter, quote, a sketch years later about a non-existent man, a total con job, playing the fake news media for fools.
Fake news.
Fake news. I don't know that this is defamation. Her attorney in the complaint said, quote, Mr. Trump used his national and international audience of millions, and he does have millions of followers on Twitter, to make a false factual statement to denigrate and attack Ms. Clifford. Donald Trump's attorneys had no comment.
Of course not.
I don't even know what you make of this.
I think it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Well, it keeps Stormy and her attorney in the spotlight. And it keeps the pressure on Donald Trump and Michael Cohen.
It takes away from the hush agreement in that whole conversation.
I think the non-disclosure agreement is just, I mean, it's not worth the paper it's printed on now. He admitted that I had no knowledge of it. Now it is, well, Michael Cohen represented me in that Stormy Daniels thing. It's like, dude, make up your mind. Either way, you didn't sign it, so it's probably not valid.
Yeah.
You know, I don't even know that this ever goes to court. I think what they really want to do is depose Donald Trump to embarrass him, which I'm not in favor of. He's the president. Again.
Dude, but he made his bed, bro.
He did, but he's the president of the United States.
It doesn't matter. And at some level, you're not above the law.
Right, but on some level, the embarrassment and the damage to the country has to be talked about. And I am not a Trump supporter. I didn't vote for the guy. I've said this 100 times. I voted for Evan McMullen.
Mm-hmm.
But Donald Trump is the president of the United States. If he fails, and I do think somewhere along the way he's going to do something or say something or that is going to get him impeached. And I don't know if it's this Russian thing or whatever. if he gets impeached and his presidency fails miserably, by the way, Mike Pence would be president and, you know, my womb would be in danger. Not that I have one, but that's what all the women say.
Rocket so I thought Man I would throw it out there. Back in business.
Yeah. I mean, Donald Trump failing as president is not good for any of us. It's not good for the United States. It'd have been great if he'd have taken office and dominated, but he hasn't. The only thing he's dominated is the headlines. And that's kind of the problem here. So we can all sit here and celebrate that Stormy Daniels sued him. And
well, listen, I don't think we're celebrating that he's getting sued by Stormy, but I do think it should be said that with all the issues that he's brought up and brought on himself, and whether it's the Russia thing, whether it's Stormy, whether it's DACA, whether, I mean, just any number of issues you want to point to, he's made his own bed, and in some respects, he's separated himself. I don't know that a lot of people view him as a true president. He is the president, sure.
He
but,
is the president.
But the Donald Trump, the figure, like the figure that is Donald Trump, I think...
They don't respect him as the president.
He's not viewed as the president. He's Donald Trump, and that's a problem.
Yeah, he is the apprentice.
Yeah.
He is the reality TV star. He is the liar who said he was a billionaire when he wasn't even a millionaire.
Yeah.
But he's also the president of the United States. You don't have to like it. You don't even have to respect him. But rooting for Donald Trump to fail, or rooting for his failure, I have no idea what that was.
Me either.
Rooting for his failure is just not smart. That's just not smart.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. So here and there. Speaking of presidents failing, before we get out of here tonight, I want to talk about Showtime. Sunday night is very important television watching in the Monty household.
Yes.
And last night was the season finale of Homeland on Showtime. And Homeland, if you don't know it, Homeland is my favorite TV show. And it features Claire Dane as a character named Carrie Matheson, a government operative for the United States. This is season 7. So essentially the storyline of season 7 mirrors the Trump-Russia scandal. Only the president, who is a female in Homeland, the president actually gets taken out of office by the Russians. She eventually gets back in, but she resigns. And
yeah.
Anyway, Carrie Matheson is one of my favorite television characters. And she also is dealing with mental illness. She's bipolar.
On the show.
Yes. So Carrie Matheson has had shock treatment and medication issues. She has a resurgent season 7. I think season 7 of Homeland is probably the second best season compared to season 1.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed this season of Homeland. But it really bothered me that they stranded Carrie Matheson in Russia for 7 months as a prisoner of war. And then when they get her back to end season 7... Her mind has melted down because she hasn't had her medication for bipolar disorder.
Yeah, 100% lost mentally.
It pissed me off. It frustrated me. It made me angry. It made me not like Saul Berenson, who is the director of national security.
But I don't know. For those of you who watch Homeland, you'll understand this conversation. If you haven't, just Google it. You'll catch up on it.
Oh,
but
and it's easy to watch all the seasons.
It
you'll
really
love
is.
It.
It's very easy. But anyway, point is, I think we disagree on what exactly happened on that episode. And for me, when I watched that episode, I think
Carrie
was portrayed as a hero in that effort to get Simone out of Russia, to distract Yevgeny and the Russians away.
She was absolutely the hero in that episode.
Right.
I agree.
And so the side effect, the sacrifice she made was the 7 months. And I don't think they just left her to die there. What was Saul going to do? He barely got on the plane to get out himself.
I don't know, but I just think that the 7 month thing doesn't do justice to the storyline. It didn't do justice to the character. You know, like that's not what Homeland's ever been. If you were going to leave her there for an extended amount of time as a POW, she needed to be tortured. She needed
to
go.
But she was.
Yeah. I guess the mental thing is torture. Yeah.
It is torture. Well, for her specifically, it's torture because she's bipolar. And I think if you've watched Homeland and you've watched every season and you understand the fight that Carrie's been through, to end season 7 with her going mentally insane because she, again, was fighting for her country by not making a false statement that would refresh the fake news saga.
Fake news.
That's another heroic act. So she essentially, again, is sacrificing her mind and body for the betterment of the country. And so that's why I say, at some point, that disease was going to come back and get her.
And I will also agree with you that the torture she was put through mentally is very fitting for the series and very fitting for season 7.
And by the way, if you look at all the people she's lost on the show, whether it was Brody or Quinn or her daughter, she's been suffering mentally the entire show. And you see that almost on an episode basis. Like every single episode, there are times where she's fighting not to cry, right? And so, I don't know, I just felt like it was really fitting. Like, no, they didn't torture her because they knew they didn't need to physically beat her up because she would never give it up anyway. They knew, and I thought it was super, I thought it was very savage of Yevgeny to tell her the pill that the Russian guy gave her was sugar and not medicine.
Yeah.
That messed her up.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of the end.
Yeah. And then there's Billions. Billions was unbelievable.
Savagely good.
Billions on Showtime, Sunday nights, 7 Pacific, is a show that not enough people are watching, and it is, I think it's one of the best shows on TV. Damian Lewis, who, by the way, was in Homeland.
He's done well for Showtime.
And they wrote him out of Homeland to do Billions, by the way. But he was in Band of Brothers, and, I mean, just a phenomenal actor.
Yeah.
He is now a true villain known as Bobby Axelrod in Billions.
Yeah.
And his nemesis on the show is Paul Giamatti, otherwise known as Chuck Rhodes.
Yes.
And I just think that it is, I can't even describe it. It is absolutely a series that you need to get on demand.
And this is not a show where you can just go into season, you know, the most recent season and watch it.
Yeah.
There's way too many.
You will never understand it.
Yeah.
You need to watch all the plot twists and the
this
character
is Game of
interaction.
Thrones.
Yeah. There's a lot of character interaction that you have to catch up on. Billions is a great show. And I think it is one of those shows that not enough people talk about.
Yeah. Man.
And Billions last night will see that if that had been the season finale last night, I'm telling you, I'd have been fine with that because that was an awesome episode of Billions. That might be one of the most surprising episodes I've ever seen of Billions. And then The Royals on E.
Underrated show, bro.
Guilty pleasure. The Royals
Underrated,
on E
man.
Is a guilty, guilty pleasure. The Royals on E is all about the royal family. But it is reality television. It's a scripted, fictional royal family. And it's the King and Queen of England and all that stuff.
It's a fun show.
It is. And it stars Elizabeth Hurley as Queen Helena. She's great. Alexandra Park is Princess Eleanor. And she's just a great character. A really good character. You know, Prince Liam, played by William Moseley. The Royals on E! You need to see it. Because the villain in that series is a guy named Max Brown who plays King Robert, and he's just a great villain.
Outstanding.
I mean, it really is. It's too complex to really describe it.
The best thing about him is he's just likable enough. You almost find yourself rooting for him only to love it when he gets crushed.
Yeah. Well, he hasn't gotten crushed yet.
Oh, it's coming.
He hasn't gotten crushed yet. Anyway, I just wanted people to know that Sunday night television is back. And that Homeland, the season finale of Homeland, really bothered me. By the way, season 8 is the last season of Homeland. And they're not going to reference season 7 at all in season 8.
Disappointing.
Which really bothers
me. Well, you know what that tells you. Carrie's done.
Yeah, she may die in that series.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would hate to see that. Anyways, that's it. Show's over. Find us online, themontyshow.com. Find us on Twitter, The Monty Show. Find us on SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play. It's all The Monty Show. Say goodbye, Jake.
Goodbye, Jake. I know you didn't know.